Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Nucleus Security. They're a company you would have heard on Risky Biz before. They aggregate information from vulnerability scanners, they normalize that information, and then plumb it through to things like ticketing systems. So you can direct things like web app and infrastructure scan results to the right people. Nucleus co-founder Scott Kufer is this week's sponsor guest, and the topic is kind of hilarious. They found a killer use case that their customers are clamoring for. Big enterprise wants it. And that feature is being able to map vulnerabilities to org groups within your enterprise so you can see who's slacking, basically. And then you can go hit them with a stick. So it seems like a feature that would be popular, like obviously in retrospect. But yeah, a software tool that tells you who's been naughty and who's been nice is turning out to be extremely popular. So we'll chat about that with Scott Kufer in this week's sponsor interview, which is coming up after the news segment with Adam Boileau, which starts now. And Adam, the founder of Group IB, the Russian, cybersecurity and threat intelligence firm, has been arrested for treason, which is, you know, it's all the rage being arrested for treason in Russia, isn't it?
It certainly is. Yeah, the story is that he's been arrested, that he's going to be tried at some point for treasonous things. They're saying that Group IB was sharing information with foreign intelligence services, which, you know, a threat intel firm, maybe that's what they do. And this is a company that was originally based in Russia and then, like, moved its headquarters to Singapore at some point and nominally became a, you know, Singaporean company whilst still obviously being, you know, Russian originally.
They actually did get quite annoyed with us once when we described them as a Russian company in the newsletter, and they wrote in and were like, we're a Singaporean company. It's like, okay, Igor, you know.
So it's kind of hard to say what's going on. I mean, things in Russia are just, who even really understands what game is being played here? Because you don't get arrested, you know, for treason in Russia for just doing treason. You get arrested for, you know, something else.
But you also get arrested in Russia for doing treason. I think, you know, this is the thing, right? Because people are like, oh, what's going on with this? And to really understand what could be driving this, you need to be a Russia expert, right? Like, it is so complicated. The politics of all of this stuff are so complicated that, you know, I don't even have an opinion, right? Because it is just, who knows? And even then, even the people who follow this stuff really closely, they might speculate on this and be wrong as well. So it really just is hard to know if it's because it's over some, internal political fight at FSB, whether or not it's because Group IB were doing stuff with the Russian state and did leak it in a treasonous way to foreign intelligence, or whether it's something else, or, you know, whether or not it's... there are some influential former criminals over there with some scores to settle. Whether or not it's that, I have no idea. But yeah, Group IB, CEO, treason.
Yep. I mean, they are saying that they are still operating, and I think the CTO or something has stepped into that role in the meantime. And, you know, it's business as usual, apparently, apart from the fact that they're, you know, CEOs in jail. But yeah, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. And, you know, maybe some listeners who understand Russian politics in the cyber world can tell us their opinions.
Dude, if you solicit opinions on Mike, we're going to get like 10 emails with 10 different theories. And that's kind of my point about Russia. Anyway, let's move on. And we're going to do our ransomware wrap. Kevin Collier at NBC has reported on a really upsetting lawsuit, actually, involving ransomware and the death of a baby in Alabama.
Yeah, the story talks about a mother who went to give birth at a hospital that was in the process of responding to a ransomware incident, and the lawsuit alleges that the subsequent death of her baby was a result of, you know, the doctors not being able to give her the care that they would have normally if all of their systems were functioning, because they were dealing with, you know, pen and paper and, a bunch of non-optimal, you know, kind of things. And she said if she had known, then maybe she would have gone to a different hospital, and that the hospital is liable for, you know, kind of not communicating that they were being ransomware. And they used the normal sorts of, you know, slightly weaselly words of like, you know, we're having a network security incident as opposed to all of our computers are being turned off by Russian criminals. So yeah, we don't know where this lawsuit's going to end up, but as much as you don't want to, you know, use such a terrible event, you know, you know, a death associated with ransomware is a thing that, you know, we've seen a bunch of people claim in the past. And, you know, if there is a more clear one, then it really does kind of make it very stark how much of a big deal this is.
Can you imagine, right? Like being in a hospital with your child and your child dies because the machine they're hooked up to can't alert staff that they're in distress, right? Which is allegedly what happened here. It's just absolutely horrible. And I think there's too much of a focus on the impact this could have on critical infrastructure and not enough focus on these types of events. And just because this is the one with a lawsuit attached to it doesn't mean it's the only one.
Yes, yeah, exactly. We've seen, you know, some examples of other people who've had to, you know, divert to other hospitals or, you know, received reduced care. And yeah, I mean, it's just a stark reminder of the actual human impact of this stuff. And if you're a ransomware operator, then, you know, this is what the blood on your hands looks like.
Yeah, exactly. Meanwhile, the Conti ransomware group is getting a little media shy, Adam, which is, I mean, I think that's a good sign that they're basically saying, look, if, you know, our negotiations leak to the press, then we're going to dump all your files and you'll never get your keys and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of funny seeing, you know, these organizations kind of try and, you know, present a somewhat legitimate front in the sense, you know, that they are, you know, just doing business and putting out press releases and kind of, you know, in many ways operating like a normal sort of business, but they're in the business of extortion. And yeah, seeing them be media shy like this is a little bit funny. And especially when the reason that a bunch of their stuff gets leaked is, you know, it's because of the mechanism that their, you know, kind of chat and negotiation system, you know, the way that that works kind of inherently exposes it. You know, people upload the samples to VirusTotal, researchers rummage through VirusTotal, find the, you know, links to the chat sites for a particular strain of the ransomware, and then are able to screenshot it. So it's kind of not even really in the victim's control sometimes. I mean, I'm sure some of the leaks do come from the victims or, you know, negotiation firms or whatever else, but a lot of this stuff is just security researchers rummaging around in VT. So yeah, Conti has clearly got a little bit salty about that. And I think
Don't upload our samples to VirusTotal so that we don't wind up in the media. It's insane.
But it's also good because it shows that some of the, you know, light that's been shone on ransomware operators, you know, over the last little while is actually making them feel squeamish, which is good.
Well, that's exactly what I thought too, which is that they're a little bit scared of the limelight here, which shows you that at least they're thinking about it, right? Like they don't appear to have really changed their behavior, but at least they're thinking about it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, some of the other stories you hear about the, you know, kind of state of the forums and the places they hang out, and, you know, there's definitely a lot more friction and a lot more, you know, perceived risk, I guess, of being, you know, in this game than there would have been 2 or 3 years ago. So, I mean, even if it isn't really changing behavior yet, it's good that some of this light, you know, is starting to make them scuttle around a bit.
Yeah, now, meanwhile, the United States plans to work with 30 countries to tackle the ransomware problem, according to this story by Catalin Kimpanu. That's NATO allies, G7 partners and whatnot. They're going to focus on the abuse of cryptocurrency and ransomware. This is a good idea, even though, you know, most of the ransomware issues are coming from one country. Forming, you know, setting up these sort of cooperation agreements are going to be quite important because, you know, who's to say that it will always be Russia that will be the problem? And it's also good making it the problem of, you know, 30 countries because that will put more heat on Russia as well. So, you know, all in all, that's a pretty good thing. Two ransomware operators have been arrested in Ukraine, mind you, and we're not really sure if they're affiliates, if they're core members of one of the gangs, but that's, you know, it's always nice to see some arrests when it comes to ransomware. And you just mentioned the drama on the forums. CyberScoop actually has a great story here from Tonya Riley talking about that. When I read this, and it's funny because you alluded to it, you know, when I read this and saw all of the friction in the forums, I just thought, now that's a golden disruption opportunity for some outside actor who wants to come in and get these people at each other.
Exactly right. I mean, that underground scene requires reputation and trust. And because they can't, you know, use the regular channels of legitimate business, you know, they have to invent their own systems for maintaining, you know, order and, you know, managing reputation in an environment where people are anonymous. You know, there has to be that kind of centralized gatekeeping, you know, escrow sort of role, you know, to facilitate the marketplace. And so, yes, targeting disruption to, you know, things like cryptocurrency exchanges obviously is one great place to do it, but also targeting disruption to, you know, the places where people find their work and get paid and arbitrate their disputes. You know, those are great places to do disruption. And the hounds do have a lot of experience in operating in forum environments, right? We saw that with ISIS and some of the other groups that have been disrupted through these exact kind of communication environments. So it makes a lot of sense for this to be a place to go. And whether or not the disruption that this particular piece is talking about, which, you know, a bunch of it focuses on like DarkSide, some of the groups that went quiet for a while and kind of jilted people, and then them, you know, the operators of those networks then showing back up 6 months later and getting a whole bunch of, you know, people pissed off with them. You know, that kind of friction, even if it's just, you know, self-inflicted, is, you know, I imagine anyone who's thinking about what sorts of things the hounds should be doing would look at this and go, hey, yeah, like degrading trust here. Absolutely, you know, a great place to introduce cost and friction and make their lives miserable.
I mean, if you could swim up into the code repos for some of these ransomware crews, somehow sneak in a decryption key and then wait till an affiliate hits a major target, then unlock them while pretending that you are actually the creator of the ransomware, all of the affiliates would abandon you. You know, like there's so many things you can do. I mean, that one's probably a little bit too obvious, but I'm just throwing it out there as like there's a lot of stuff you can do to exploit the dynamic between, you know, for example, ransomware developers and affiliates. So, yeah, fun stuff to think about. Meanwhile, a ransomware attack has hit a bunch of, like hundreds of bookstores across Europe in France, Belgium, and the Netherlands. Catalan has that story. This attack targeted a software as a service platform that offers software for bookstores, right? So it's affected so many. And I'm just thinking, oh, you messed with the Dutch. What are you doing?
And they're bookstores as well.
Yeah, like, exactly.
I mean, that's really asking for trouble right there. I'm just glad that there are bookstores still. I mean, that's nice.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised. Like hundreds, really?
Yeah. Thousands, apparently, of bookstores use this kind of inventory management software. But yeah, that's just, I'm just glad there's bookstores. So that's good news story of the week.
Now, Martin Matyshak has a story up for The Record, and I found this one really interesting because it's got some really strong comments in it from General Paul Nakasone, who is, of course, the head of the NSA and Cyber Command. Now, he was speaking at the Mandiant Cyber Defense Summit in Washington, and he basically came straight out and said that ransomware is not just a criminal activity best handled by the FBI. And I'll read to you a direct quote in this story. When ransomware starts impacting our critical infrastructure, it's significant. If it isn't important to US Cyber Command and the National Security Agency, who are built for the express purpose of defending the nation, there's something wrong there. Ransomware is a national security issue. I firmly believe that. Now, that puts him squarely on Team Release the Hounds, right? So at least we know where he stands there. Now, what I didn't know is that he has actually made similar comments in the past. One of the friends of the show pointed out that he made similar comments a few weeks ago at another public forum. So that's really interesting that you got Nakasone saying, oh, yeah, this is a NatSec issue and this is not a job for the FBI. This is a job for us. It just screams, let me at him, doesn't it?
It does. And he also said that some effort to go and, you know, establish, you know, understanding of the threat and figure out their tactics and how to get in front of them was, quote, going on right now, unquote, but did not provide any specifics. So
that means there's a lot of collection going on right now.
I think so, right? And, you know, it kind of makes a lot of sense that, you know, they are from a SIGINT background. And before you go and do operations, obviously you need to do your reconnaissance. You need to understand who and when and where and who they're, you know, the relationships and the networks and how best to target your activity and to, you know, prepare the battle space, as they like to say. And yeah, I'm sure there's a dossier being prepared that describes all the available options. And then Biden can, you know, say, I would like two of number seven and one of number three, please.
Yeah, I mean, that's what this feels like, right? Which is Nakasone is just waiting for the green light. He's waiting for someone to ask him, well, what are our options here? And he'd say, well, pull out the two-pager out of his briefcase. You know what I mean? Yeah. Did you get that vibe from it as well?
Yeah, that's kind of what it feels like, and kind of makes sense, right? I mean, yeah. It clearly has transcended regular crime and they can't deal with it through regular crime channels. And what do you got left, right?
Yep, indeed. Now we've got a story, a few outlets have covered this because it popped up in an SEC filing, but a company called Cineverse, which is apparently some really important like telco messaging back end thing. Like you talk us through this, Adam, because you're the telco enthusiast among us.
So this is a company that handles like interconnection between telcos and like bill reconciliation and, you know, roaming arrangements. So basically provides a mechanism for, you know, if you're a telco and you want to have your customers interact, send text messages, you know, route phone calls, bill phone calls from other, you know, while you're roaming, then this is a sort of place that does that as a service, so that you don't have to have kind of bilateral arrangements with every other telco on the planet to support that sort of thing. So they handle, you know, a bunch of billing records, call records, but also text messages between carriers. And according to reporting, based on their SEC filing, they have been owned for quite a long time. And we don't really know what this means yet. Potentially, if you were in that environment and you wanted to intercept context of text messages, then you probably could. Text messages going between carriers. That seems like it would be ideal for criminal groups that want to jack SMS-based multi-factor auth. But of course, you know, call data records, who's calling who, who's leaving who voicemails, all that kind of thing is very, very transigent.
It is, but I mean, this whole story, right? The thing that I found funny about it is, so I'm looking at Lorenzo Franceschi Beggari's story for Vice, and he's quoted a bunch of really credible people, like Carsten Knoll is one of them, as saying like, oh baby, like, you know, you own this company, you get access to so much good stuff. It is like such a good target, pretty devastating sort of stuff. But then he's also got a quote from, an unnamed insider at the company that was owned, who's like, eh. Basically saying not much happened, because, you know, they're someone who was not really authorized to talk to the press. So it's actually hard to know whether this was like a few opportunistic shells or whether it was some major SIGINT thing. Like, we just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the chances that some, you know, hoary old Solaris box gets shelled by some kids at a telco, like, that's just...
Kids,
you know,
don't shell Solaris anymore, well, okay. Adam, but that's,
I mean,
funny.
You know, okay, middle-aged folk like me maybe shell Solaris boxes. I don't know what the kids shell these days, you know, like AWS.
Yeah, they do it all with SSRF and, you know.
Yeah, exactly. They do, and they get great shells with it and great bounties. Yeah, I mean, the idea that old crappy stuff at telcos gets owned, like, that is just every day. And I think it may well be a why not both sort of, you know, why don't we have both situation here? I mean, I'm sure a platform like that with crappy security that can get owned by kids is also owned by all of the SIGINT agencies for, you know, collecting call data records, because why wouldn't they? It's their job. And the fact that some kids are in there as well, you know, that's just orcs. But yeah, we just don't really know. I think the thing I liked about this is a result of SEC filings, right? And yeah, this is an example of why moving towards more disclosure of breaches and more requirements for people to talk about the bad things happening is important, because the fact they've been owned for 5 years and we and presumably shareholders are only finding out about it now, it suggests why we need these things.
Yeah. Well, we also don't know when they found out necessarily about this, right? So that's something to keep in mind. Oh man, a bit of a bit of an issue over at Coinbase, where 6,000 accounts had funds stolen from them. Apparently, Coinbase is going to make them whole, because it was Coinbase's fault, because there was some sort of logic flaw in their like SMS account recovery feature, which doesn't sound very good. I mean, 6,000 accounts, you're thinking if it's one or two people who figured this out, that's a lot of accounts. They would have had a decent payday.
Yeah, exactly. We haven't seen a total number for how much was nicked through this mechanism. But yeah, it's a pretty common thing, you know, when we see people implement multi-factor auth, you know, that there are a lot of, you know, kind of edge cases and situations to think about, especially in things like, you know, password reset flows, or, you know, other than, you know, things other than just the regular login flow, like enrollment or account lockout and re-enablement, or, you know, there's lots of edge cases and people do, you know, mess this stuff up, and like logic bugs, you know, or out of order, you know, calling a flow, you know, calling something that's in a reset flow at the end, you know, without having done the earlier steps. There's lots of things that can go wrong. So not super surprised that it would happen. You know,
the fact it's only 6,000. I get that, but, you know, the thing is, like, these companies usually have very competent security teams, right? I'm just sort of surprised that you would have a bug like this. I mean, look, I say that without knowing the nature of the bug. It could have been something really leaked.
It might have been something fancy. Yeah, it absolutely could have been. Yeah, I mean, the stuff's fiddly, and, you know, it pays to have someone look at it that is an expert in busting this particular sort of thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Krebs has a good story up just about the proliferation of, and this is kind of a little bit related to the last one, the proliferation in one-time password interception bots, because this is something that attackers have always been able to do it, but now people are offering it as a service, which means, you know, you can essentially, once you've got someone's username and password, you know, this is a way to get their OTP and log in as them, right? So I think we can really say that the case for wide-scale U2F-based MFA is pretty well established at this point, and this story kind of adds to that case.
Yeah, services like this, which is a thing that will like phone a user via the traditional like voice phone call a user and say, hey, we've detected a security issue in your account. Please enter an entry from your one-time password generator to verify your identity. And then that just passes that back to the attacker who they can then use the credentials they've already got from somewhere else to go and log in, bypass multi-factor. Packaging that up as a service and making it available, like this is just like bots on Telegram that you can just kind of message and do this, on a scalable elastic charging model, etc. Very, very hip, very now. Yeah, makes this stuff super available, and it does indicate why things like U2F are important, because you can't expect users to not fall for that. Like, it's just not reasonable. And once it's weaponized and available for everybody, then it's time to move to more robust mechanisms.
Catalin Campano at The Record reports that the FCC is about to work on rules to prevent SIM swapping attacks, which is great, but maybe 10 years too late.
And you may ask, what are the rules? And turns out they haven't got the rules yet. This is the beginning of the formal rulemaking process in which they ask people questions about what rules they might like, maybe, at some point in the future. So I guess if you have opinions about things you'd like the FCC to tell people to do, then you can go and participate in the formal rulemaking process. But in about 10 years from now, maybe they'll say, actually, how about it be good if you didn't let other people port numbers without asking the customer first?
Yeah, that might be an idea. Maybe give them a call and see, And if you can't reach them immediately because their phone is being essentially DOSed by the person who's in the shop, trying to reset their number. It's a hard problem to solve though, right? Because if you demand like 100 points of ID, people roll up with 100 points of fake ID. And, I'm not saying that it's an easy thing to fix, but I also do think it's funny that the FCC is like just getting onto this now.
Little behind the ball there, yes.
Just a little bit. Now, we've got two stories here that kind of go together. One is from Tom Brewster over at Forbes, and the other one is from Mark Harris at Wired. So the Wired one is about, talking about that Google geofence warrant that helped catch people who participated in the January 6 riots in Washington there. And, we've seen a number of stories of this type run over the last few months because, geofence warrants are very serious. But the Tom Brewster one, I think, is even more interesting, right? Which is, it's written up a little bit breathlessly saying, exclusive, government secretly orders Google to identify anyone who searched a sexual assault victim's name, address, and telephone number. So the story goes that police asked Google to hand over information pertaining to anyone who searched for a particular address on one of 16 days. That they specified, right? Which were apparently days that were leading up to the kidnap of a minor who was subsequently trafficked, okay? Now, I'm having a real hard time getting upset about this because I think, if one of my children were to be abducted from my house, I would think that the police asking Google who might have searched my address in the lead up to that abduction, I would think that would just be good police work. There seems to be some pretty strange expectations around privacy. I think it would be unfortunate if police were to use these types of techniques for trivial crimes, misdemeanors, to selectively apply these techniques. But again, and this is something that you and I, it's a theme that we come back to quite often, as with targeted interception, as with facial recognition, all of this stuff is good as long as it's used selectively and proportionally. Tom Uren, our newsletter editor, he's writing up something on this for tomorrow's newsletter, which I'm really looking forward to because he's great at this stuff. But what were your thoughts reading this story?
I guess I was struck by the tone, and I guess it's an American lens in both of the geofence and this kind of keyword warrant case. There's an American kind of cultural feelings about privacy and freedom and stuff that perhaps are a bit different to you and I, our experiences down here in Australasia. But I was struck by, sort of the vehemence of defending privacy, the idea that a Google keyword search warrant, show us everyone who searched for a particular set of terms over a particular time period, or this kind of geographically bounded warrant for Google information. Like comparing that to the extent to which that stuff is shared with commercial entities and advertisers just willy-nilly, with very little care or oversight or thought, that juxtaposition seems a bit weird. And if anything, America needs kind of in my opinion, more control of the commercial and advertising-centric aspects of how their data is used, and maybe a little less crazy and a little more proportional and a little more, you know, kind of pragmatism on the, you know, dealing with very serious crimes and using the tools that are available to law enforcement.
Well, I think, and this is something else that comes up in these discussions, right? I think another reason, and I'll point out too that Tom Brewster is actually English, not American, but you know, he is certainly writing it up in a point of view that does come across quite American. I think one difference, though, you and I as an Australian and as a Kiwi, we have a somewhat different relationship with our law enforcement than people That's in true. America, yes. Where you know you've got counties who operate law enforcement. Here, all cops are state cops, and our states are gigantic, so you have things like slightly better oversight and more uniform training on stuff like, you know, accessing people's data and stuff like that. So I think that's, you know, there are some pretty significant sort of cultural and, you know, societal reasons that the United States, citizens of the United States take a dim view of, you know, everyone who happens to be called law enforcement, which is a lot of people being able to do this stuff. But at the same time, you know, I just read this story and I thought, you know, I couldn't think of a more appropriate use of this technique than what was being spelled out. Yeah,
exactly right. I mean, sexual trafficking of a minor, like what bar would have to meet for this to be appropriate if it's not that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And it, Tom and I were talking about this yesterday. There was a lot of panic, I think, you know, in the immediately post-Snowden, when people realized that the Americans and all of the Five Eyes partners could start putting keywords into XKeyscore, right? Which was that was the system that kept basically a rolling buffer of every packet that passed through the internet, more or less. you know, and they're like, oh my God, they're doing keyword searches. But the sort of stuff that they would use, you got to think about, well, what's useful? And what was useful is like, hey, one of our friends at CIA just got this phone number, which is for one of Bin Laden's couriers. You know what I mean? That's the sort of stuff that they're keyword searching for. You know, us as little babies used to think, oh, they're doing keyword searches for bomb and jihad. And it's like, no, they're not. They're doing searches for this person's email address because, you know, they're associated with this person and we're trying to expand that out. And I think that's something to keep in mind, right? Like this technique is only useful when you target it, right?
Yes,
it's not going to be useful when you broaden it out and because you're going to get too many hits. And it doesn't prove anything. It doesn't have any evidentiary value. This is just a good investigative tool.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the level of specificity here, you know, and the fact, I mean, there is obviously warrants involved. Like there's a bunch of oversight involved with getting these things. Google has some requirements. There's kind of a multi-step process where Google provides the first set of answers with non-identifiable to individual users. So they say like device 3, search this, and device 4, search that, and give them some times and other metadata. And then the cops can come back with a second round and ask for the identities of some subset of those results. So there's already a, you know, a bunch of kind of controls in place to limit the, you know, kind of dragnet level stuff. But as you said, that's just not useful for actual pragmatic police work. And in the case of the, you know, Capitol riots, like, you know, once they'd ruled out everybody who was, you know, had like some legit reason to be at the Capitol, state employees and those sorts of things, then pretty much everyone there, you know, was a reasonable, you know, they had a warrant for, you know, reasonable suspicion that they were involved. And both of those seemed adequately constrained to me and, you know, suggest that the oversight process and the warrant gathering process, and certainly, you know, Google's experience in dealing with law enforcement around the world, you know, is also useful at kind of constraining that a little bit. And just kind of seems like this is working like kind of how you would hope.
I mean, if they were asking for data on users who were outside the Capitol building, that would be different. You know, if they were just asking for information on all of the protesters, right, who happened to be in DC that day, that would be inappropriate. But, you know, if you were in that building, you were trespassing. So kind of like that's okay.
Yeah. And I mean, it's also funny because, of course, those things are organized for and largely for the consumption of social media. So people have to take their devices. And so then using the device data to figure out who was there because they wanted to show off to their friends. That's kind of, I think it's kind of funny, to be honest. But
Maybe a little. we've got a report here from Chris Bing, which I'm glad he got to be the one to write it. The US intelligence community's budget bill could place new controls and reporting requirements on former US spies, as that's his lead for his report at Reuters. So he's got a couple of quotes in here from House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff. These new requirements are aimed squarely at ex-USIC people who are thinking about going off and doing a Project Raven-style post-IC employment gig, and it looks like pretty sensible stuff to me. Like, I'm frankly surprised that something, you know, more stringent controls weren't in place already.
Yeah, and obviously this has not gone through all the process yet, but it's kind of interesting to see what sorts of, you know, specific constraints, you know, they are starting to think about. So one of the examples was a requirement for, I think, 30 months after leaving the IC, you know, kind of embargo on working for foreign governments, including through a private company, shockingly. Well, that's in reference to. Good to see what those kind of look like. Obviously, the concern, you know, here is that people who are thinking about going into the IC, you know, if these restrictions, because when we talked about it previously, there was some, it wasn't clear whether we'd end up with just people who've been through the IC or, you know, anyone who can cyber would be constrained in that way, you know, whether our brains would be ITAR controlled or whatever. But yeah, so seeing something that's kind of,
well, I mean, you got to start somewhere, right? Which is my answer to this.
You do got to start somewhere. But yeah, it makes you wonder whether people will think twice about going to work for the IC if they know that it's going to apply a whole bunch of constraints to them for a long time afterwards.
I think that's going to be a conservative talking point, but I don't buy it.
You don't think so? You don't think kids are going to go, but what if I want to go to?
I don't think most kids who join the IC are doing it so they can, you know, hook up a sweet gig afterwards hacking 15-year-olds for sheiks, you know? Like, I don't think that's, you know, of the people I've known who've gone into that world, they do it for two reasons, right? They do it because they want to help their country and they want to learn cool stuff, right? That's why they do it. And most of them will go out to the private sector and stay in the United States. It's an extremely small subset who go, oh, I've learned all of these really cool techniques from working in the classified world, I'm going to move to some country with a terrible human rights record and put those skills to use. You know, like, that is just, God. I mean, frankly, I'm stunned we need these rules at all. Like, at all.
I guess you're right.
When you put it like that, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, when you put it like that.
Adam Janofsky over at The Record has reported that the Department of Homeland Security and NIST have released post-quantum cryptography guidance. This isn't the first time we've seen guidance, you know, emerge from standards bodies talking about this sort of stuff. I often say this is like InfoSec global warming. It's something that everybody should be doing something about, but basically no one is. And, you know, I think we're going to see a steady drumbeat of more and more guidance coming out about this, because imagine how much sensitive data that's encrypted is currently being captured to disk right now in the hopes that someone might be able to crack it in 10 years, right? So, you know, we should be doing stuff with certain categories of data. We should be doing stuff right now to make it quantum resistant.
Yeah, I mean, clearly you are right. And I think the analogy to, you know, global warming, climate change makes a lot of sense, because, like, it is a thing that's going to happen. It is happening. We will get working quantum cryptography almost certainly, or attacks, you know, quantum techniques to attack, you know, regular cryptography. But on the other hand, you look at the list of guidance that came out of this particular, you know, the roadmap, you know, 7-point roadmap of things that you should do. And number one is organizations should direct their chief information officers to increase their engagement with standards developing organizations for latest developments relating to the necessary algorithm and dependent protocol changes.
I thought that was funny too, because that's NIST saying, please talk to us.
Yeah, we'd like some friends, please. But it's like, how many CIOs do you know that got time for that, right? I mean, yeah. They're busy dealing with our passwords on Monday one, and we have single factor auth, and we just moved everything to Azure, and oh dear, right? And Azure is filled with OMI and other. Like, ain't no one got time to think about quantum cryptography.
yeah. But I mean, they've got some more actionable guidance there, like organizations should inventory the most sensitive and critical data sets that must be secured for an extended amount of time. You know, like, that seems like a pretty reasonable thing to do given the, you know, given what we're talking about.
Yes, like, there are some reasonable things, and obviously understanding what data that you have in your environment and how important it is and classification, you know, those are things that you would hope a CIO had already done. But yeah, whether or not they're secured by cryptography that's vulnerable to quantum techniques, yeah, I mean, they're more worried about whether or not they got their PCI tick this month or not.
Washington Post has a great write-up on the new regulations that have come in for pipelines, including, you know, the specifics of the regulations. What's really funny about this one is, as regular listeners would know, I do a bit of work with the Airlock Digital people, and they make allow listing software. And when they saw this story And it, you know, it turns out that allow listing is actually a requirement for pipeline operators now. And they're like, oh my God, this explains so much, because they'd been getting so much inbound inquiries from like pipeline companies in America. And they're like, what on earth? And yeah, they have to. So that explains that.
Which is good. They probably should.
Yes.
I mean, some of the other recommendations are a little bit, you know, they could do with some finessing and some adjustment for reality. Things like, you know, a regularly applying patching to systems on the OT side, you know, probably going to cause more problems. Like, they're probably going to cause more availability problems than you're going to have being
hacked. And there's a lack of clarity in some of the guidance about whether or not you're talking about the IT network or the OT network. So it's, you know, it's not great, but it'll get there.
Yeah, and it's certainly good to see progress. And I mean, much as I hate to say it, you know, one good ransomwareing per sector, you know, per critical infrastructure sector would probably help everybody along. And the fact that we're just doing pipelines now, and this has moved quickly just because Colonial Pipeline got themselves ransomed, you know, it goes to show the public good of ransomware.
Well, you know, you say that, but I think it's just that energy is such a push button topic for Americans, right?
Like, yeah, we haven't seen chicken nugget security regulations yet, despite the attack on chicken nuggets. So.
Yeah, or you know, meatworks or hospitals, which I think is the one I always come back to. But yeah.
It is weird that we got this so quickly for pipelines, and yet hospitals been wrecked for years.
Ah, now Adam, we all know that protecting critical infrastructure is very important. But what about systematically important critical infrastructure? Now, look, I'm gonna make some jokes about this because I find it very funny that, you know, 20 years ago we decided that we were going to have to cyber protect all of the critical infrastructure, and that's a pretty long list. So now essentially DHS is standing up a list of systematically important critical infrastructure, or SICI, right? Now, I'm going to make fun of it, but it does make sense, right? There are going to be some things that are super critical. But I'm just disappointed they didn't call it super duper critical infrastructure, because that would have been such a better name and really captures the meaning. But yeah, it does look like the United States is sort of adjusting its list of systematically important critical infrastructure. It does feel like the US government, even though its progress is slow, it does feel like the US government is at least trying to get its hands around an awful lot at the moment. Do you get the same feeling?
Yeah, it does feel like they're making progress. And obviously it's taken a while and taken a bunch of hits to get them to do this. But it does feel, you know, kind of reminds me of, you know, that period where Microsoft started being good again. You know, and they started to gradually do things right and make some progress. And it kind of felt like the trajectory was in the right direction. And that's kind of what it feels like with, you know, the US government cybering lately.
That's exactly how I felt about it too, because we'd seen a few stories about, oh, a couple of good things, a couple of sensible regulations, a couple of good laws. And you just sort of think, okay, they'll do that and then they'll forget about it. But it just seems like it's continuing, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think they have suffered, you know, kind of enough pain to really push them, you know, in the right direction. And, you know, I mean, this is a great example, right? I mean, yes, there's lots of critical infrastructure. You know, back in the old days, we just had computers, and then they figured, okay, some of it is more important. And when you start to draw that list of critical infrastructure, you know, every, you know, water purification facility in every tiny state of, you know, every little backwater place in the United States, like, that's a really big list. And if you try and solve all of that at once, you know, you are going to be there for a long time. And they do understand that, you know, if someone hits a water chlorination thing with extra chlorine, whatever it was, in some place in Florida, okay, that sucks, but it's not as bad as the entire Eastern Seaboard having no oil and gas.
Yeah.
So I
should be clear that, you know, the story that we're talking about, a Republican, the top Republican on the House Homeland Security Committee, has actually introduced legislation that would instruct CISA to draw up this list of super duper critical infrastructure. I'm not going to say the correct way, systematically important. No, it is super duper critical infrastructure. So in fact, if there are any Democrats listening, if you want to do one amendment, that would be the amendment I would ask for. Super duper, not systematically important, super duper.
Super duper, global hyper mega critical infrastructure. That's what we get next.
That'll be the next bill in a few years.
The next thing, yes, yeah.
But yeah, look, anyway, let's move on from that. We got another one from Catalan here. As usual, this week's show contains 40% by volume, Catalan Kimpanu stories. We got a story here just about some academic research into China's Great Firewall. Surprise, surprise. They're blocking ESNI, right? Which was, you know, Blind Freddy could see that coming. But I think there's some interesting stuff in here anyway, because they're talking about how there's a bit more depth to the Great Firewall than maybe people realize.
Yeah, I mean, they've been doing research where, you know, they kind of you know, probe the Great Firewall to try and understand like its makeup internally and the way that, you know, so for example, there's different sorts of appliances that handle individual protocols. And then when they were looking specifically at how HTTPS was handled, one of the things they've discovered is that there's at least a couple of different layers of HTTPS filtering, handling different parts, or maybe handling redundancy or load balancing or some kind of, vendor diversity or defense in depth or whatever they're trying to do there. By looking at, say, like the way that a connection is torn down when it violates some rules. So for example, you're using any SNI header. And so some of the, they were able to kind of craft packets that will go through the first layer and then be rejected by the second layer. And they can see that the kind of TCP reset looks a bit different or whatever else. So from that, they can kind of, you know, sort of, it's kind of like echo, you know, like sonar or, you know, like echo range finding or something, like using these sorts of techniques to reflect off stuff in the environment to kind of figure out what's there. So yeah, interesting research, and good to understand a bit more about what it looks like on the inside.
Yeah. But I tell you, that's the least surprising thing I've ever seen, which is that the Great Firewall of China just says no to ESNI. Yeah. Oh no, this is a, look, I just want to mention this one quickly because I was just really surprised it didn't get a bigger run as a news item. Bleeping Computer had it. And then there was another write-up in ZDNet as well. But Bandwidth .com, which handles an awful lot of VoIP traffic, right, as an upstream provider to a whole bunch of different companies. I think even Google and Microsoft might use some of their VoIP services for like Teams and Meet. And I'm not 100% sure on that. But either way, Bandwidth.com, big deal. They were getting hammered with a DOS attack. As far as I know, it's over, but they were up and down like a yo-yo for something like 5 days, and it barely made the news. Whereas you take Facebook down for 10 minutes and my God, it's a urgent news flash.
Yeah, so they provide backend services for a whole, as you said, a whole bunch of VoIP providers, and it's not super clear whether Bandwidth.com were being denial of service, or maybe one of their downstream customers was, or, you know, some other part of their, you know, related infrastructure. But yeah, net result was a bunch of voice services, and for, you know, a lot of people that, you know, rely entirely on VoIP. I mean, that can be, you know, mean emergency calling is not available. So, you know, pretty serious, even when, you know, voice comms is not as important as it once was. But yeah, funny that it didn't make such a splash. You would expect more from a big provider like that.
Well, and they have good mitigations in place, apparently, right? So you got to worry when a company literally called Bandwidth.com has run out of bandwidth, right? Like, and this doesn't make the news? How?
Yeah, that's a good question. We did see a few bits of gossip from, you know, people posting on Reddit and stuff, you know, about some of the details, but yeah, they I think have at least confirmed that it was denial of service. Service seems to be restored, but yeah, we don't know how big it was or exactly why or who was being targeted.
Now, here's one from Ars Technica written by Jim Salter. It's also run on Wired. Now, when I read this headline, I got ready to roll my eyes hard, okay? Because the headline is, a simple bug is leaving AirTag users vulnerable to an attack. And I thought, this is going to be super lame. And it's actually not. It's actually kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's exactly the roller coaster I had as well, because it sounds clickbaity as a headline, but was not. So this was, you stick an AirTag on your stuff and it gets lost, and then people can find it, scan it with an Apple device or your other devices, and then it redirects you off to an Apple site where you can find the details of the owner of the device. It turns out you could cross-site script the like phone number field that you associate with a particular tag such that it would then, you know, run code in the context of like, you know, found.apple.com, whatever it is that you end up going to. That's terrible. But that seems like a pretty obvious thing to not screw up and to test for. That's cross-site scripting. This is not exactly, you know, some crazy quantum technique here. But yeah, so like turning that into a thing that fishes for iCloud creds or something, right? I mean, and then just dropping a bunch of tags around the place. Like,
it's the new dropping a USB in the, yeah, in the car, exactly, park, right? Yes. Just drop an AirTag and get XSS and some creds.
So yeah, but A, weird that Apple would ship that and not, you know, not test for it. B, someone, of course, found it in the wild, tried to report it to Apple through their bug bounty program, got salty with the lack of responsiveness from Apple and kind of dropped it for public disclosure on Medium, which is a story that, you know, I'm thinking how many weeks we've run the someone gets salty with Apple bug bounty story. Yeah. So definitely some, you know, some things to work on there, Apple, with the comms.
Yeah, but yeah. Although AirTags, you know, let's not poo-poo all over them. They were a pretty well thought out product, and you know, I was actually kind of impressed when we talked about like the anti abuse stuff in them. You know,
but I mean, this implementation, like, this is a bug that, you know, an automated scanner should have found. Like, you shouldn't need a you know, a human and a bug bounty program to catch cross-site scripting in one of the few input fields in the solution, you know?
I know what you mean. You know, yeah. We all make mistakes though, Adam. We all do. What else have we got here? We got an Apache bug.
Apache, what are you doing?
It's so good. An Apache directory traversal bug. Woo!
A directory, like path traversal bug in the year 2021 AD in the world's most widely used web server. And it looks exactly like an IIS bug from like 2007.
Well, 2001.
Path traversal, but using like URI encoded dot characters, like %2E. Like literally IIS had that bug 20 years ago, right? This is ridiculous. But anyway, so it's a particularly recent version of Apache, which probably most people aren't running yet. So that's the kind of saving grace here. But it is pretty ridiculous to have a bug like this in Apache HTTPD. Like, what the?
Yeah, I mean, I woke up to a message from my friend who admins risky.biz just saying, when you see the news, you know, of this Apache bug, just know it doesn't affect you. So I'm guessing he didn't upgrade us to that version. So thanks, guy. What else have we got? Oh, this one's great, man. This is a story, another one from Tonya Riley at CyberScoop. Apparently, a group of attackers out there is posing as Amnesty International pushing their anti-Pegasus solution, right? So they're sending this thing to people who are sort of likely to be targeted by NSO group software, right? Like activists and whatnot, and saying, you know, make sure you don't have NSO software, and then dropping something presumably that looks a lot like NSO software on them.
It's a little bit ironic, yes, that they're using that lure. But it just goes to show it. There's no point wasting a good lure. Like anything that happens, you can get people to click on the thing. It doesn't matter what it is. So, yeah, why not an anti-Pegasus lure? But yeah, the researchers who've been looking into this say it shares a bunch of infrastructure and, you know, other kind of TDPs and things with Russians. So, yes, Russians impersonating Amnesty, claiming to solve Israeli problems because globalized world.
It is indeed a globalized world. And yeah, look, I mentioned it earlier, but there was a huge Facebook outage, yesterday? That got a lot of news, but I mean, I just found it like not very interesting because you can tell it was just something dumb happened and then Facebook went down. And it was something dumb, wasn't it? Wasn't it something they misrouted their, like they did some BGP announcement that sunk their domain name servers or something dumb like that?
Yeah, I think they just kind of stopped announcing a bunch of their networks and then it sounded like their management of the routers and the data centers went across the networks that were being advertised. So at that point, they don't have remote access to fix it on the other end. And then all of their internal tools were gone and their building access control was gone and they were just having a bad time by the sound of it. And it's a good reminder of, you know, maybe thinking about what a cold restart looks like in your environment because not very many people exercise that. Like, how do we start from cold and dark and turn our network back on? Because, you know, people don't do that anymore.
Now, one thing I just want to talk about quickly before we go is The Record and a few other outlets have carried this report. The headline says, report, new PCR test intelligence around Wuhan suggests COVID-19 was virulent earlier than thought. Now, this is based off research by a company based in Australia called Internet 2.0. This is the same company that pushed scraped Chinese data as being a huge breach. Jeremy Kirk kind of debunked that one last year in September. I've linked through to that in the show notes. If you want to see how much stock to put into Internet 2.0's findings, go have a look at their website. And that's all I'm going to say. But yes, Adam, that is actually it for this week's news. Thank you so much for joining us, my friend. And we'll do it again next week, which will be, I think, after next week. I am taking 2 weeks off because I need to sleep train a six-month-old, which is going to be so much fun. So much fun. Can't wait. But yeah, bud, thanks again. We'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, thanks, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a chat about the week's security news. It is time for this week's sponsor interview with Scott Kufa now. Scott is the co-founder of Nucleus Security. And Nucleus makes a tool that I think I've always thought makes a lot of sense. Their platform ingests vulnerability scan results from a whole bunch of other tools, and then it normalizes those results. So you can have stuff like Nessus scan results normalized and sitting next to like NetSparker scan results. And from there, you can plumb this stuff through to ticketing systems or Slack or whatever you want. The idea being you could get the scan information or the scan results, individual scan results, to the people who can actually act on them. So from an operational point of view, it makes a lot of sense. But Scott is here to tell us that enterprises actually want tools to help them manage the people who manage the vulnerabilities. So an absolutely massively popular new feature for them is the ability to essentially generate a heat map of vulnerabilities in an enterprise and overlay that on an org chart. And that way you can see which divisions and managers are on top of things and which ones need help. So it's a fantastic way to inject a bit of accountability into enterprise vuln management. And I just think it's interesting. So here is Scott Kufer talking about all of that.
What we were trying to do originally was to solve a lot of the challenges that we were experiencing as vulnerability management analysts ourselves internally to what we were doing. And then what we realized is we started working with really large enterprises because basically the tools that we were trying to sell are tools that are most geared towards companies that have a lot of infrastructure and a lot of data coming in.
Well, they're the ones who are going to need a management tool, right? Because the smaller companies, they don't, you know, it's an easier problem, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you might only have 3 or 4 tools instead of 17, 18 different tools and 7 CIOs and whatnot. Yeah, so we solve a lot of those scale problems. And we had all of these hypotheses around what enterprises want and what we felt like they needed. And the features that we thought we were going to be really impactful ended up kind of being cart before the horse. So,
Start by telling us what the features you thought were going to be useful were.
We originally started out thinking that the features that would be the most impactful would really be about automating response, around automating, you know, plumbing the tickets to the appropriate tools and the Jiras and the ServiceNows of the world. And we really thought that was where we fit. We thought we were going to be a vulnerability management middleware. And I remember when we first pitched this on Snake Oilers a couple of years ago, we told everybody that we were a solve real problems type of tool because we really felt like those were the challenges that enterprises had. And then we started working with enterprises and found out that that was very much something that is great, but not the primary problem that enterprises are having. And so the biggest and most impactful feature.
Well, it might be still the primary problem that they're having, but I think more accurately, it's maybe not the primary problem that they want to solve.
Right. So it turns out the most impactful feature for an enterprise is an org chart with vulnerabilities overlaid on top of it. So basically, they want to be able to take all of their vulnerability asset and threat intelligence data, and they want to be able to map it out and correlate it to basically who owns what within their organization and keep that up to date.
And so they want to see what's glowing red so that management can take their sticks and go and beat up their underlings with it. Is that about kind of why they want it?
It appears to be that is a driving factor, yes. It sounds so simple is the crazy part about this. They have this organizational information about who's responsible for what, and they want all of the vulnerability asset and threat data available for those business owners to be able to go in and see what they are responsible for and then to resolve on their own terms. So the automation and the tracking and the triage and the reporting really comes into play once the business owner actually logs in and uses Nucleus for that purpose. But like upper management really wants to be able to say, okay, CIO number 2, let me see your vulnerability data. And how are you doing over the last 60 days hitting your SLAs?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. You're great. You're doing slightly better than CIO number 3. Let's go punish people or reward people depending on the organization.
Yeah. No, and it makes a lot of sense. And it's not that much of a stretch from what you were already doing, because I think one of the things that I personally always liked, you know, as a non-practitioner, the thing that made sense to me was that you were able to, and this was from day one, you were talking about being able to attribute different vulnerabilities across the stack to different owners, right? Like, and you were talking about, you know, who owns that bug. So that attribution's always been there. It's just funny that turning that into like a heat map for senior management to go and yell at people is like turning into a major driver of sales, right? Because it's not...
It is.
Yeah, it's not that much. I mean, what you're describing is not would not have really been all that much additional work for you, I can't imagine.
It was not, because what was already there was the ability to say, okay, we are scanning with our DAST, SAST, SCA, infrastructure tools, cloud configuration, and whatnot. We're going to pool all of that together into what we call the product, right? And so you could have a product line that has all of these different scans and assessments. And then they just wanted to be able to say, okay, it's cool that we have this product object. Now we just want to nest that product object within a team and then nest that team object within a business unit, within a division, within a CIO. And everybody at every layer of that organizational hierarchy can go see all products across all teams that they are responsible for.
But I mean, this is going to enable And I mean, as much as we're talking about whacking people with sticks and, you know, that might be sending the wrong message about, you know, appropriate management practices and whatever, but I mean, accountability is important, right? And if you've actually got a tool that can enable that, that I can see, I can definitely see why management types like this idea.
For sure. And the craziest part about this is that it is something that makes a lot of sense. And accountability was just something that's impossible, really. I mean,
yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I'm getting at is previously you could say, oh, we got this many vulnerabilities present, you know, after a Nessus scan and after this scan and after that scan. But like, right. What do you do from a management point of view apart from try to generally improve your patching practices or, you know, code remediation practices? Like that's a big task. Whereas if you can see that there's one division that clearly needs help or is clearly doing it wrong, like that's actually a problem you can work.
Right. It kind of makes it actionable. Whereas before you always had this amorphous, well, we need to do better, or we need to prioritize better, or we need to fix X number of vulnerabilities or patch better. And now we can really drive actionable insights and say, okay, well, we have these SLAs even, right? So it was even impossible to track SLAs across your entire organization. Now we could say, okay, we have a 7-day critical SLA window for urgent issues, and which business units are actually able to meet that, and which ones are 150 days instead, and how can we help them actually get up to standard?
Well, and that's the interesting part, right? Because you will very quickly see who's doing it right and who's doing it wrong. And then you can just go to the people who are doing it right and say, well, you know, how are you managing to achieve this? And can you go talk to Gus? Because he's really not...
Yes, there's always a Gus. It's funny because we also see this across not just large enterprises, but across every customer segment that we have, right? If you're a DevOps shop and you've got all of these products and different product owners, and you have this ability to have each product owner log in and see what is actually they're responsible for, and then all of the priorities of vulnerabilities based on all of the standard fancy risk-based vulnerability management stuff. And everybody, you can actually create this drive towards a self-service model where management has the ability to keep people accountable and to drive real KPIs and goals. And then at the lower levels of the organization, you can use all of the existing automation and the frameworks around the self-service model to essentially segment it out and distribute the correct information to the right users. And then they can build their own automation on top of it, which allows for huge amounts of success for all of our customers that we see adopting this model. And it seems to be the way that most organizations would prefer to actually manage their vulnerability data.
I can imagine too that sometimes some of the people who are responsible for a particular category of, you know, patching or vuln management or whatever, they might not necessarily know, right? So they're gonna, you know, that might have slipped through the cracks, right? So they might log into this thing and say, what do you mean we're supposed to have done this? You know, we didn't know. Is that a thing, right, that happens or?
Absolutely. That's actually a huge problem. And we see it because
that's the thing, right? A lot of this stuff, we always talk about how it slips through the cracks, right? Like under this model, it's not really possible because every single vulnerability needs to be assigned to an owner.
Right. And on top of that too, the ability to even say, okay, we have application type vulnerabilities versus operating system level vulnerabilities on the exact same hosts and infrastructure are oftentimes owned by different parties and different teams. So if I've got my SAP team going in and they're responsible for patching and upgrading SAP, but the underlying operating system is actually owned by a different team. How do you segment out who owns which vulnerabilities? And how do you hold each one of those teams accountable for their own patching process, their own vulnerability management process? And that's a really difficult thing because right now you really only have ServiceNow, and to try to somehow correlate ServiceNow data or some other CMDB type situation, we know how that goes, to your vulnerability data, it just doesn't really go well unless you try to do something and build your own tool to do it for you.
It's funny, you were just, you know, just talking about all the CMDB stuff, and that just made me think of recent conversations I've had with HD Moore regarding Rumble. You support Rumble, don't you?
We do. Rumble was one of our first asset inventory integrations, and that was actually a really fun experience because of that, we got to work with HD directly, and it was in the early days of Rumble, so we got to work with him pretty hands-on, and we...
He's it a machine, actually, isn't he?
He is such a machine. He talks and works so quickly. I know. But he actually helped us define and generalize some of our ideas around how to do asset management within Nucleus as well. Because the way that he did it in Rumble was just so clever. Being able to use that for matching and to be able to take that data, it forced us to grow up and mature in how we actually match asset information in the platform.
So look, while I've got you here, just in terms of general trends, interesting stuff you're seeing, you obviously integrate with a lot of different technologies. You're one of those vendors that touches a lot of other vendors, right? Is there a new tech that's popped up on your horizon or anything that's like really impressing you? Or can you think of anything along those lines that you can share with our audience where people have plugged in this new scanner and it's really amazing or anything like that?
I would say this in the scanner market, it's still pretty competitive. You tend to have some of the same vendors popping up over and over again. I would say where the real innovation is happening is much more in the asset management space, because asset management, you know, as we've mentioned before, is kind of the first step to a good solid vulnerability management program. And so we see that there are companies out there like Axonius, for example, who do essentially the asset management. They're the nucleus of asset management. And then we can work with them to pull the data in of this aggregated asset inventory with all of those types of pieces of information I was talking about earlier around who owns what, where do they sit in the organization. And then it just works in a completely automated way. So when you start combining a nucleus with an asset inventory tool like that or an asset aggregation tool, that's where it really starts to become a powerful platform together.
All right, Scott Kufer, thank you so much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about, what you found is the best way to enable managers to go around and yell at people. I'm sure everybody's very thankful for you for that. Great to chat to you, my friend. I'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks again, Pat.
That was Scott Kufer there with a chat about the latest features in Nucleus. Big thanks to Scott for that. And you can find them at nucleussec.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back in your feeds soon. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.